Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the luckiest politician alive today, who is perhaps about to make history having won just one election that depended entirely on as few as possible voters showing up at the polls, whose second election just 4 years later could propel him to the highest office in the land as leader of the free world, not because he is popular, but only because he is not the other guy. Wayne Slater, a longtime political writer for the Dallas Morning News, who has covered Ted Cruz since he came out of nowhere to become the junior senator from Texas, joins us to explain how possibly the most untested politician in American history, who has just one quirky off-year election with only 600,000 votes cast, could be poised to be a major American political party's nominee for president of the United States. Then we will speak with Todd Gitlin, a sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism at Columbia University, about the dueling Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, both claiming the other is not qualified to be president, a ludicrous claim when you consider the meteoric free ride that Ted Cruz has had, but nevertheless a sign of a tense and tight race shaping up for them in the New York and Pennsylvania primaries. The author of Occupy Nation, The Roots, The Spirit, and the Promise of the Occupy Movement and Letters to a Young Activist, Todd Gitlin will also assess the political future of the youth movement that Bernie Sanders has inspired. Then finally, we'll look into why America has the highest rate of childhood poverty than all but a few developed nations, with 17% of America's children living below the poverty line. Jeff Madrick, the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation, joins us to discuss how child poverty can and should be addressed in the richest country in the history of the world, and his article in the New York Times, Handouts Are Often Better Than a Hand Up. Joining us now is Wayne Slater, a longtime political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clemens, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and Greg Abbott. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne Slater.
Wonderful to be with you as always.
And thank you, Wayne. And your junior senator there, Ted Cruz, has got to be one of the luckiest politicians on the face of the earth. He got elected in a very quirky, off-year, off-schedule election to the U.S. Senate based upon the fact that nobody showed up to vote. And now he's poised to be the Republican nominee, not because of anything that any virtues that he has, but for the simple fact that he's not Donald Trump. I mean, how lucky can you get?
Well, he is lucky. You know, his entire political career, which frankly is very brief, he's won one election, is basically summed up around the idea that he's never been the guy that you like, but he's has been the guy that you dislike less than the other guy. In Texas, when he ran, he ran not as someone who had a great name ID, but around the Tea Party message in a primary where nobody showed up except Tea Party, the most staunch and enthusiastic Tea Party advocates. And so, although almost nobody showed up in Texas, they liked him better than the other guy. And so, you're right. He finds himself today in this kind of strange position of being not the guy that anybody likes, because nobody in the almost nobody in the U.S. Senate likes him, his colleagues, but as the guy who apparently some members of the Republican Party dislike less than they like Donald Trump. Now that is a wonderful opportunity. That's what I would call political luck or fortune.
So let's dig in then to how it was that he won this election against to replace Kay Bailey Hutchinson in the U.S. Senate. Her seat was supposed to go to Dewhurst, the lieutenant governor. And this upstart came out of nowhere. He was, what was he, Solicitor General of Texas?
Solicitor General. In other words, basically all that means is he was the number one assistant to the Attorney General, had argued some cases before the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of the Attorney General of Texas, a conservative named Greg Abbott, now the governor, and basically had never won a political race in his life. But he saw an opportunity in 2012. In 2012, he saw the rise of the Tea Party from 2010, 2011, 2012. He saw the anti-establishment, anti-Washington, anti-everything movement. And he saw that as an opportunity to run for U.S. Senate, for Kay Bailey Hutchison's seat, the long-standing Republican state senator, Republican U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, was leaving. The anointed candidate was the establishment candidate, Lieutenant Governor, tall, sleek, conservative, experienced. He had been Lieutenant Governor. He was a self-made millionaire. He was everything that you would think in the classic sense that Republicans would want. And yet in that year, 2012, what Cruz saw was that what people really wanted was, at least what Tea Party voters, what a minority sort of constituency of Tea Party voters wanted, was the outsider, the disruptor, the Tea Party advocate, the person who would take it to the establishment. And that's exactly what he did. Now, the advantage for Cruz was that normally Texas would be part of Super Tuesday, the cluster of states, as in this year, we had almost 3 million people vote in the Republican primary in March. But because of a quirk, because of a circumstance, that our redistricting plan, as approved by the legislature, challenged by Democrats, was in court, that the date of our primary was pushed back from March to the end of May. Now, what that means is, by the end of May, basically the Republican primaries were over. Romney was going to be the nominee. There really wasn't much drama there, not a lot to bring people to the vote. So Cruz challenges the establishment candidate, Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, and he finds himself in a runoff. That was the key. How can you make yourself not win? Because you're never going to win in a straight-up race. But can you go to a runoff where only a handful of people, the true believers, show up?
And this is the weather is getting hot, right? It's these are lazy days, right?
It is. It was just our runoff. Again, to think about it, our primary was normally going to be in March 6th when everybody would show up, a contested Republican primary, an establishment candidate in Texas, and a conservative candidate might do well. But our primary was moved till May. And then the runoff, because Cruz found himself in a runoff against this establishment figure in July 31st, everybody who isn't in the mountains or on the beach or, you know, doing whatever people really do in real life or watching the Olympics on television, everybody on July 31st is not voting. You didn't even know there was a primary runoff going on. And so Cruz found himself as, although he finished second in the balloting for the primary, in the runoff, he was running against the establishment. About 1 million people showed up, which in a state like Texas is not many people. Cruz won with about 630,000 votes. That is a tiny vote. That is what elects members of U.S. Congress in close races, where you have races. But this was a U.S. Senate race, and Cruz was able to argue the point to this select group of passionate, Tea Party voters. I'm the Tea Party guy. I'm against the establishment. My opponent is the establishment, is Washington, which is kind of absurd because nobody in Texas politics, Republican Texas politics, wants to associate with Washington. But he was able to sell this passionate constituency, this minority, this tiny minority of 600,000 voters, that he was the guy, and on July 31st, 2012, he was effectively elected the U.S. Senator. Now, he had to go through a general election vote in November of 2012, but the Democratic Party right now is so weak in Texas that the Republican nominee, in this case Ted Cruz, with about as many votes as it would take to win a congressional race, found himself the next U.S. Senator of Texas, and that's where he was.
And again, I'm speaking with Wayne Slater, who is a longtime political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administrations of Texas Governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and Greg Abbott. So isn't this extraordinary, though, in this current election year? Obviously, there's a lot of talk about Donald Trump's lack of political experience, which in many ways is helping him with his constituency as an outsider. But on the Democratic side, there's sort of overt and covert criticism of Bernie Sanders' lack of experience or lack of specifics. But Bernie Sanders has been elected, I think, maybe 10 times for various races, mayors,
right.
congressmen,
right.
senators. And this guy that could be the Republican nominee for President of the United States, Ted Cruz, has only had one election where he depended upon as few as possible people showing up to vote, and he managed to win that election. Talk about being untested. You can't make a case compared to any other politician in this race, particularly Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. You can't accuse them of being untested, but you sure as hell can accuse Cruz are being untested. So,
well, yeah, the amazing thing is that you're right. On the Democratic side, clearly we have two candidates who are vying for the nomination, both of whom have substantial, certainly Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, have substantial electoral experience and experience in public policy. And the Republican side, you have someone with absolutely no experience, and that would be Donald Trump, and Ted Cruz, who has virtually no experience, in the sense that Ted Cruz has won one election in which he really depended on nobody voting, only a relatively handful of people voting. And moreover, Cruz's experience in the U.S. Senate has been to defy the, quote, establishment of the Republican Party in the Senate. But he's become the perfect person at this moment in this disruption in the Republican Party, where the farther away from Washington, the farther away from the establishment, the farther away, frankly, from experience in public policy you can get, apparently that wins you some kind of medal in the Republican Party. And so that Cruz finds himself, now think about this, as the candidate who is luckily, or by virtue of the circumstances, found himself with virtually no voters voting for him, in a position to become the candidate nominee for the presidency of the United States of a major political party. If the situation were different, and we can always look at revisionist history, let's say there had been no Trump. There had been no Trump, and this campaign was Bush and Kasich and Scott Walker and other more conventional Republican figures, conservative, maybe Tea Party advocates, maybe whatever your cup of tea is in the Republican Party, but not Trump, not the ultimate disruptor. And Cruz, you would never see Cruz in this position. You might see him second place as the candidate of the anti-establishment, but the establishment figure, whether it would be Bush or Kasich or Scott Walker or whoever, you would have to think in a normal, quote, normal year, would have been clearly the favorite, clearly would have had the votes, clearly would have had the delegates, and probably would have had this whole thing wrapped up before the convention. But Cruz finds himself in this alternate universe, this bizarro world, in which Donald Trump, the Orange Don, as some people call him, is the most outrageous, outlandish expression of anxiety, of fear of outsiders, of a discontent with the institutions of our government. And so Cruz finds himself in an odd place as being, quote, the establishment placeholder, so that he is, again, not the guy you like and you want, but the guy that you dislike less than the other guy, Donald Trump. This is a marvelous moment in luck or strategy, or maybe, Ian, maybe this is what God wants. If we believe what God wants, then maybe God is telling us something. And in this case, what they're telling us is Ted Cruz is in this wonderful place where luck presents himself in an inexplicable place, possibly on the cusp of the presidency of the United States, having been elected by a handful of people in one election with almost no experience.
Well, if he's got an inside track with God, it must be through his father, who's an itinerant preacher and a dominionist at that. So, you know, when just listening to what you're laying out there, Wayne, it occurred to me that maybe Cruz is smart, really smarter than most people, and certainly smarter than those candidates. That was a big field, remember, of Republican hopefuls. He sort of bided his time and allowed Trump to knock all the others off. And he never went after Trump. And, you know, he kept a sort of respectful relationship going with Trump up until it came down to him and Trump, pretty much, you know, or just towards the end when it was unavoidable, when Trump started to call him Lying Ted, etc.
Right. I look at the sort of the structure of this race as a political scientist. Not that I am a political scientist, but as a longtime reporter, I watch this. The structures of these things. Cruz has been strategic throughout. He's understood that, look, he's never going to win as the most popular guy, but he's going to win if circumstances comport themselves in a way that make him a potential selection. He's strategic. Trump is instinctive. He does stuff, I think, more based on instinct, which can accrue to his favor, sometimes not so much to his favor. But Cruz has been strategic all along.
Well, there's no question, Wayne Slater, that Ted Cruz does have a good ground game and a good organization, and he's been focusing on delegates long before Donald Trump figured it out that that's where the rubber meets the road. And my understanding is that Donald Trump basically, maybe he sort of entered it almost as a lark. I don't think he's ever wanted to be president so much as win the presidency. And only when he got these massive crowds did he sort of realize, my God, something's happening here, and sort of was going along with it for the ride and improvising. And only now has he brought in Paul Manafort and these professionals to deal with the delegate issue and obviously to fight this convention floor fight that is shaping up. So there's no question, again, you got to hand it to Ted Cruz. He's had his eye on the prize all along, and he's very strategic and very calculating.
One of the amazing things about Trump, and I know that your listeners and others have found this kind of wildly amusing, is that the rules are great until the rules don't work. And so when you run for an election in Texas or most states except maybe Louisiana and some others, if you don't win a majority of votes, you go to a runoff. There is a system. There are a set of rules. That's what's the situation today in the Republican Party. But what Trump is essentially trying to argue increasingly is that I've been cheated. This thing has been stolen from me. Now, whether that argument will prevail or whether the Cruz basic method, which is to try to lock up delegates on a second and third vote, will prevail, we'll see. We'll ultimately see. It's kind of a variation of the rule of law. Well, what about the rule of the rules? in this case, the rules are what the rules are, and it is entirely possible that Cruz could emerge from Cleveland as the Republican nominee of this party as the clearest expression of constitutional conservatism as many conservative Republicans see, and that Trump will be seen as kind of an asterisk. But let me propose something else. Trump, and I know this is something you've talked about on your program, a number of social scientists have seen the Trump emergence, not only as the appeal of the strong man and the and the discontent with the establishment. But as the appeal of the authoritarian instinct, not dictators and Hitler, that's all, you know, that's
hyperbole,
nonsense.
Yeah.
That's, but as the as someone who independently there was an instinct in individuals in Texas, an emerging instinct, maybe a minority, that they don't like the other person. They don't like what's happened to their basically to their life, and that Trump is speaking to that. These are not dictators, but this is sort of psychological profile of individual voters characterized by, you know, voters who want order and have a fear of outsiders, persons who want a higher degree of authoritarianism, not Hitler, but someone who is strong. And when they feel threatened, they want a strong leader. Now, here's the question, Ian, and this is the larger question that I think we will be debating after November, depending on what happens. Is this authoritarian instinct real, or is it an aberration? If it is real, does it live beyond Donald Trump, and will it affect our politics for a long time?
Well, on that note, Wayne Slater, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Wonderful to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wayne Slater, who is a longtime political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and Greg Abbott. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back assessing the political future of the youth movement that Bernie Sanders has inspired.
New York, you're perfect. Oh, please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect, I mean all disrespect. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Todd Gitlin, an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's the former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He is the author of Undying, a novel, and Letters to a Young Activist. And his latest book is Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. And his forthcoming novel is The Opposition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd Gitlin.
Hi, Ian.
So, Todd, there's a little, more than a little bit of animus now emerging between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. They're both obviously at a critical juncture now that New York State, then followed by Pennsylvania, are the key states, and they're campaigning pretty heavily in both. And not to mention, of course, on the other side, Donald Trump, a third New Yorker, in effect, in the race. But there has been up until now a fairly conspicuous comparison between the relative civility, adult behavior, and, you know, useful debate about policy and politics on the Democratic side, in stark contrast to the name-calling and juvenile schoolyard brawls that have been going on the Republican side. But now things are sharpening up between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, each suggesting the other is not qualified to be president. Do you find this a turn for the worst?
Well, actually, this must have just happened, because these quotations are unfamiliar to me. If these are matters of the last 24-hour,
right.
24 hours, I'm out of that loop. Whatever loop it is, I'm out of. So, but look, it's not surprising that individual politicians, whether outsiders or insiders, get invested in their campaigns, which are, after all, you know, defining adventures for them and identity packed with meaning. And they, as they fight, over who they are rather than confining themselves to who, what they declare themselves in favor of. I think, relatively speaking, we're still getting, you know, quite a complete, quite a clean campaign out of the Democrats, in that they're at pains to try to define themselves with respect to the world that most Americans live in. But it wouldn't be at all be surprising if they were yakking at each other and nipping at each other, because that's actually the story of American politics. I mean, take a look at Thomas Jefferson's first campaign if you want to see some some teeth shredding, shredded with the flesh of the opponent. So I don't think that's awfully significant. I mean, it's a sign of intense competition.
Well, I think the significance, though, to me is that, you know, assuming that Hillary Clinton wins and she's got a delegate lead, and Bernie Sanders is, from now on, has got a pretty high bar. He's got to win an awful lot of these remaining states by a considerable margin to catch up. But he is on a roll. There's no question about it. But the question would be, how disillusioned would the Bernie's supporters, who are young and very passionate, feel if he didn't make it, or if there was a perception that Hillary Clinton used the sort of superdelegate ruse to take the nomination? She needs his people in the general. She's already not particularly popular and not particularly charismatic on the stump. So isn't that the ultimate challenge that the Democrats have?
Well, it is a big challenge, and it always is when there's a fierce race, and every once in a while, first race for the nomination, and every once in a while, some of the defeated are sufficiently sour that they declare that they'll never show up. I mean, in 2008, the Hillary people even had a kind of quasi organization that showed up in Denver at the convention, declaring that never, you know, under pain of bodily harm, would they show up to vote for Barack Obama. So it's not to say it can't happen, but, you know, it certainly was the case in 1968 that supporters of Bobby Kennedy and then Gene McCarthy refused to show up and vote for Hubert Humphrey. But it's also true that McCarthy himself failed to lead them toward recognition that Hubert Humphrey would do a lot more for the world than Richard Nixon. I think what's important here is that you put your finger on something terribly important, and it's not entirely in Bernie Sanders' hands. Here is a pack of voters and politically committed people, citizens, who are disgusted by the general course of the Democratic Party over years or decades, and they succeeded in turning the center of attention in the campaign from what it had been. They succeeded in making it unignorable that the Democratic Party has a left wing, and that it's substantial, and that it's heavily young, which means likely to be able to continue. And the question is, what do they do? Now, Bernie recognized this very early. In fact, it startled some of the usual observers after his victory, I believe, in New Hampshire. That very night, he said, "Now let's remember, we're going to have a unified party. We're going to, you know," which was, to the normal political observer, this was an odd sort of thing to be saying at this moment of conflict to a sharp edge, when you know, he was sort of looking forward to a time when his people would be listening to him to either carry them back into Hillary's Democratic Party or to ditch her. So I think, you know, I take that to be a sign that he recognized quite early that some of his people, or many of his people, would be looking to him to remind them of the difference between Hillary Clinton and the Trump or the Cruz. I think that he is, if he's not the nominee, which seems likely, I think he will very likely be articulating the same tone. I mean, I can't imagine that he has much of an idea of a personal political future. I think his fate, his contribution to history rests on his ability to move the people who've come behind him, to his surprise, and many others, to move them into becoming an enduring force. And now we get to the real problem, which is that there is, I believe, not much of a Bernie Sanders organization, any more than there was much of a Howard Dean organization in 2004. And the trick in moving the center of gravity of American politics past this appalling center point that it's been at, right center point, the trick is to mobilize people who will stay in the game, who not just turn out for exciting primaries, not just turn out for presidential races, not even just for governorships. They'll turn out for local elections. They'll turn out for city council and mayors. They'll turn out for for state assemblies. This is where the right has been hammering the left into the ground. It's not only that they've controlled Congress in the last round, but that they've controlled the state houses. They control 30 out of 50 states. They control legislation. That's where the Koch brothers' investment is paid off. Now, in order to fight that, you need to create a machine. It's a party within a party. It's the Sandersites and so on. It's what Ralph Nader should have done if he hadn't been carried away by himself in 2000. It's what many people have advocated over time as a role for a dissenting but substantial body within the Democratic Party. It's what Michael Harrington was advocating in the 70s and 80s.
Sure,
and
sure.
So the question is, can that materialize? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I don't think that Bernie can make it happen at the snap of his fingers, but I think he ought to be thinking about what he and others he's been working with can do to create this ongoing force.
Well, I've always been puzzled by the obvious difference in the case of the Republicans. If the radical right-wing Tea Party could become the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, why can't the progressives in the Democratic Party take over the party? It's always been a puzzlement, particularly when you've got brain-dead people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz running the DNC.
Well, I think it's the right question. And the answer is that the Democrats who are the more radical Democrats are bored by trivial local politics. It's too hard. It's too demanding. It's too tedious. It requires thinking beyond the next corner. I mean, not to deprecate, you know, our people unwarrantedly, but I think that the fun is in the breakthrough moment. The fun is in the belief that now we have a champion who can walk through water. You know, in 2008, many people thought that was a Barack Obama. Today, many people think it's Bernie Sanders. It's neither. Politics comes from, you know, an accumulation of power at every level. And many people say this every few years, somebody says it, and there's some lip service and not much changes.
And it does seem, of course, there is a consistency here. After all, when Obama was running, Obama's mantra was, yes, we can. It wasn't, yes, he can. The minute that he was elected, the expectation was that our new man on a white horse would solve all of our problems, and all we had to do was press the button, punch our ticket for democracy, and walk away. And that seems to be the tendency. But now you've got so many young people fired up by Bernie Sanders, and you know, logically speaking, they could be the future of the Democratic Party. So that's really the trick, isn't it? How do you engineer and coalesce a movement that continues on? Howard Dean's Democracy for America sort of limps along now, but it's a shadow of itself. So,
Bernie says there needs to be a political revolution, which is actually undeniable. But okay, once you accept that, then, okay, what do I do when I wake up in the morning to serve, to advance the political revolution? And I don't think he's offered much on that score. Maybe he's not thinking about it. He should be thinking about it, and the people around him should be thinking about it, because if the Bernies do not, you know, if they simply, you know, go back to ground and grouse, then, you know, the political revolution, you know, will have, you know, a half-life of 5 minutes. You know, I think the next stage is to get serious about what that actually entails.
And is there a roadmap to follow? I mean, you know, I've often observed that after the Vietnam War, when Nixon ended the Vietnam War, that massive movement that you were one of the people that helped organize sort of dissipated and went away and didn't keep the government's feet on the fire.
Well, it had other problems, which are always, you know, built into the sectarian mentality, which thrives in political movements, both left and right. You know, there is no overriding political course that is recommended now. Sort of, one could always say about the Vietnam War, well, what do we do about it? We leave. We go. And that was really not that much more needed to be said about the war. There's a lot more that needs to be said about how to reform the plutocratic system. And but it needs not just to be said, it needs to be organized. And here, again, at the risk of repeating myself, it is not enough to have lists of people who've come to rallies or have been roped into listservs. There need to be organizers on the ground. There need to be people installing themselves in the party. There need to be people recruiting candidates. There need to be, you know, a sort of a charter of common issues. Maybe there need to be national meetings. Maybe there need to be statewide meetings at which, you know, the question is put to potential Democrats, are you signed on with, you know, this sort of the equivalent of what the Republicans once called the Contract for America? I've thought of the analogy of the 19th century Chartist movement in Britain. Can you agree upon a set of reforms which are which, you know, become the vortex or the spearhead of a reform movement over time, in which Democrats have to, or those who want to run as Democrats have to declare whether they're on with this reform program or not. I mean, many, many things would have to be done, but you'd have to be thinking in terms of actually, you have to be thinking, you know, logistically and in terms of materiel and, you know, in the sense of an ongoing campaign, like a military campaign. It has to be organized. You can't just conjure it up every few years when people are exasperated by the status quo. It has to have legs.
Well, I think the one thing that Bernie Sanders, and of course he has been accused of not being strong on specifics, but in terms of calling for a revolution, he's made it pretty clear that it will take a revolution to dislodge the power of Wall Street. I mean, it's taken decades since Reagan came on the scene to pull off this oligarchical project. You know, we have fluctuations in our history going back to, say, to the Gilded Age, where you fluctuate between plutonomy and democracy. And now we're in full-bore plutonomy at the moment. And they do, obviously, I mean, I just covered the Labor Department's new rules so that you're not going to be fleecing seniors with their retirement funds, their 401ks and IRAs. And it's extraordinary that, you know, you have to pass a very weak, lukewarm kind of set of rules not to steal $17 billion a year from our seniors. And I'm talking about the Wall Street people. And it just gives you an idea of how much power they have.
You can't diagram a political revolution, but you can sketch it.
Right.
And the sketch, and it doesn't have to be the same sketch that stays engraved in granite for decades. Probably shouldn't be, but it ought to be possible at any given time, like now, to articulate a set of reforms. It could have to do with Wall Street transaction tax, could have to do with campaign finance reform. You know, I mean, it's not for me to go on, but that's not horrendously difficult to do. All the stakeholders, unions, liberal groups, others would have to come together and agree that, you know, for the next year, this is the platform. And this is the basis on which it's on this basis of this platform that we're recruiting potential candidates, and we're going to be raising funds and pouring them in those directions. I don't think that's a utopian project. I think that's doable.
No, and indeed, in the current news cycle, we have the Panama Papers, which make a very clear case that without the big Wall Street banks taking this money from these shell companies, and there's no requirement for them to identify who the proprietary owner is of the shell company, if you can't even change that law, which is a blatant and flagrant ripoff, you can at least tax these offshore. And the estimated is there's about $32 trillion offshore. So there are many, many things that can be done.
Yeah, and you just need to base together at least a temporary convergence. Maybe that's why that one's too complicated. Maybe it would be simpler to say tax earned income at no higher rate than capital gains. I mean, that's much more easily said. And it's very hard to defend the so-called carried interest provision that enables hedge fund operators to pay less tax or no tax compared to their secretaries on their income. Again, you know, what's important, I think, is not so much the particulars of the program. And I'm not saying that, you know, Bernie Sanders has to be able to draw diagrams every time he's asked by an editorial board what are his quote-unquote positions, because all politicians are, you know, sort of operating on the fly to try to piece together proposals, and it's an absurd test to require of them that they, you know, say exactly what are you going to do and exactly how you're going to pay for it. That's a sort of childish thing we have in as a substitute for actual discussions of principle. I'm not talking about specific policies or pieces of legislation, but principle. You can have that discussion about principle, and you can have a convergence, and it's not that hard.
Well, Todd Gitlin, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's the former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the author of Undying, a novel, and Letters to a Young Activist, and his latest book is Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street, and his forthcoming novel is The Opposition. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into why America has the highest rate of childhood poverty in all but a few developed nations.
Paranoia strikes deep. Into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now, what's that sound?
Poor boy, head against a pillow fast asleep. Poor girl, head against a window lost in dream. But one day they will be as giants, stronger than the sun. But that day ain't yet come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He's director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation. And his books include Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance, and The Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. And his latest book is Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. And he has an article in Thursday's New York Times, handouts are often better than a hand up. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Nice to speak with you, Ian. And that article's on the op-ed page, in case anybody looks for it.
Absolutely. No, I picked it up this morning. That's my exercise in the morning. I walk down the driveway and get the New York Times. So,
but nobody knows how long your driveway is.
No. Right. But I opened it and was, oh, my God, I'm going to be talking to Jeff today. So, but, you know, the subject matter is pretty damning. And the fact that America has the highest rate of childhood poverty than all but a few developed nations, with 70% of American children living below the poverty line, that is just unconscionable. And the poverty line, of course, is
17,
17%. And the poverty line is $24,000 for a family of four. And then just in terms of just following on from that, a third of these kids are white, another third are Latino, and about one quarter are black, while the rest are American, Indian, and Asian American. I'm quoting from your article, Jeff. Why then, in the richest country in the history of the world, do we tolerate this shameful fact?
I can't quite explain why we tolerate it. I have theories, but the reason we have so many poor kids, it's not because we have so many poor adults. It's because we don't have proper programs for these kids. We've made a policy choice. Maybe some Americans don't fully understand that. But we've made a policy choice to let these kids suffer. And the damage done by child poverty is quite clear. It continues through life. More poor kids go to prison. More poor kids make lower wages. They don't finish high school, so forth and so on. It's a tragedy for them because they suffer, and it's a tragedy for the American economy because we don't utilize our human capital for our economy. It's pretty awful.
Well, there is a reason, at least the one that you put forward in your article, Jeff Madrick, that the United States once had a welfare program for children, the Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And in 1996, legislation was put forward by congressional Republicans and supported by President Bill Clinton to end the AFDC welfare as we know it and put in a new regime called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And that, the TANF system, only deals with 23 out of 100 poor families.
Right.
Compared to its predecessor. So there you have, you know, 77 out of 100 poor families suffering unnecessarily.
Well, we went from a bad welfare program. The AFDC was pretty skimpy to begin with. And if you worked, you reduced your welfare payments and so forth in the old program. And then we went to a worse program for poor people, the pants, because a lot of people just can't get jobs, and then you don't get any benefits at all if you can't get jobs. And especially in this period since the Great Crash, when jobs for low-income people have been very scarce. And furthermore, poor people have a hard time getting to jobs. Poor mothers don't have time with their kids. The relationship to work is very tenuous. And that TANF program, what's really criminal about the TANF program, Ian, is it didn't come with a job creation program. Now, if I remember right, Bill Clinton wanted that kind of program, but he gave in anyway because the Republicans wouldn't attach that kind of program to this TANF, which demanded that people work. Imagine that you demand that poor people work and you give them some training, but you don't provide jobs, and the American economy didn't provide jobs.
Right, and then you add on your only reforms, if you will, are to insist that these poor people get tested for drug use. I mean, it's just this lust to punish the poor that exists, particularly in the right wing in this country, is pretty hard to fathom.
Right.
And I guess denial is pretty handy in this regard. And the fact that I don't think the public is educated in any way about why it is that this shouldn't be the case in the richest land in the history of the world. I mean, for example, in Australia, when I first took my daughter over, I think she was about 2 years old, I was told by everybody, well, you know, you can sign her up for what's called child endowment, which would have meant that she would have gotten over $200 a month paid to her until she was 18 years old. This payment goes directly to the mother. It doesn't go to the father. It's paid into the mother's bank account. And that ensures that the child is going to be fed. And if you're wealthy enough, then, you know, you end up with a good college fund for the kid. But that is a national birthright. You know, you don't have to, just because you're a citizen of the country, you get that. I mean, I don't believe that American people have any concept of how shortchanged they are in terms of a lack of a social democracy, the very thing that Bernie Sanders is talking about, compared to this welfare to the right wing that goes on with agribusiness and the military-industrial complex. I mean, when I read your article, I thought, my God, you know, all the money that you're talking about that should be funneled to kids so that at least half of them aren't going to be poor in this country is the equivalent of what they're wasting on one stupid jet airplane, the F-35, that doesn't work.
I did want to make clear that in the late 1990s, when there were a lot of jobs, when there was a boom, the TANF welfare program wasn't that bad. Poor people could get jobs. Now, when we're back to reality and there are no jobs in a weaker economy, or at least a job poor economy or a low wage economy, it's just not working and we don't care. We are the only, almost the only rich nation that doesn't provide cash allowances for children. Canada does, as you say, Australia does, almost all of rich Europe does, South America does, they call it the bolsa, I think, in Mexico. In South America, they have conditions. If you want the money, the kid has to go to school, the child has to go to the doctor, and so forth. But in Europe and Canada and Australia, there are no conditions. They assume the parents know what to do with that money. And that is such a mature idea. But the fact is, let's face it, in America, many Americans, and it's kind of a part of our national character, we believe if you're poor, it's your fault. And we're not going to help you. And if we help you, you'll stay poorer. If we don't help you, you'll pull yourself up by the bootstraps if everybody has a truly equal opportunity. And it just ain't so. And we're talking about kids here. Even if you blame the poor for being poor, you can't blame poor kids for being poor.
And again, I'm joined by Jeff Madrick, who is the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation. And he has an article in Thursday's New York Times, an op-ed, "Handouts Are Often Better Than a Hand Up." And we were just talking before you came on the program, Jeff, with Todd Gitlin, talking about all these young people that Bernie Sanders is bringing out and inspiring, and what kind of a political movement might follow, since these young people are the future of the country. But you're talking about something far deeper, in the sense that all of the children that are the future of this country, 17% of them are being shortchanged right out of the gate.
Yeah, it's a big percentage. And, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but child poverty is related literally to brain damage. It's basically incontrovertible now that kids who live in poverty because of what's now called toxic stress in their families and their lifestyles. I don't mean getting beaten. I mean just plain psychological stress. Can have brain damage. Their brains are literally diminished in size. We're talking on average here, of course.
So you mean all of that stuff that happened in Flint, Michigan with the lead in the water, which alarmed a lot of people, and obviously and rightly so, because you had a Republican governor who's a venture capitalist who's blissfully unaware of, you know, the consequences of making budget cuts and doing this austerity orthodoxy that all these people on the right are hooked on. You're saying that as bad as the lead poisoning is, that there's also pervasive damage being done to the brains of kids simply because of the environments that they're growing up in?
Yeah, the extreme stress, parental stress, not knowing when they're going to get their next meal, not knowing, having to move from apartment or house to house, living in overcrowded conditions, that what's now called by neurologists, not by progressive analysts, but by neurologists, toxic stress has led to measurable decreases in the size of the brain, the hippocampus, for example, as determined by MRIs. A guy at Harvard named Shankman leads the research in this direction. And this brain damage may well be irreversible. So if that's the case, we have 30s and 40s-year-olds walking around who grew up in poverty who have brain damage, and their doctors don't know it, their employers don't know it, their army sergeants don't know it, and the prison guards don't know it. So I think that, you know, we got to stop this while we can.
Well, you're implying also that the societal cost further down increase as well. So I don't know what the ratio would be to the cost of incarceration. And we know that, you know, that prisons are full, particularly of young African-American men. And we have the dubious distinction of having the greatest prison population on the planet. Is there a connection there? And what would the ratio between the kind of call that you have in your article in the New York Times, Jeff Madrick, which is that if you could cut child poverty in half and it would cost $200 billion a year in this country, just to cut it in half. But how does that compare to the societal costs of...
of prisons.
Yeah.
I don't have the numbers at my fingertips. I'm sorry, Ian. But child poverty and... incarceration are directly related. And I am writing a book about this, by the way, for Knopf's Publishing. And I'll have the numbers by then, that's for sure.
Well, I'm going to revisit you then.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah. I would like that.
Well, I thank you for pointing this out. It's a bitter pill, but it's real. And it is a shame that we all share in. So I thank you, Jeff. Go ahead.
And we can do something about it. And it's always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He's the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation and editor of Challenge Magazine. And his books include Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. And his latest book is Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. And he has an op-ed in Thursday's New York Times, Handouts Are Often Better Than a Hand Up. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.